Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News special report. The FBI believes the man who drove a pickup truck into a crowd in New Orleans this morning, killing 10 people, had help. FBI agent Alethea Duncan.
This is an ongoing investigation that's rapidly evolving.
Agent Duncan says 42-year-old Shamsuddin Jabbar, an American citizen from Texas, was prepared to do a lot of damage.
Weapons and potential improvised explosive devices, IEDs, were located in the subject's vehicle. Other potential IEDs were also located in the French Quarter. As of now, two IEDs have been found and rendered safe.
CBS's Nicole Skanga says a handgun and an AR-15-style weapon were found, and that's not all.
Law enforcement sources telling us that at least four IEDs, improvised explosive devices, were recovered from the scene of the crash. And at this point, trying to connect the dots to determine whether, you know, those IEDs would have been viable.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Community Stories is taking a holiday break for the month of January. I'm your host, Melissa Kay, and the show will be back in February with more stories from your community.
For Civic Media News, I'm Lisa Hale. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is sharing recycling tips for the end of the holiday season. According to a press release, DNR officials are reminding residents that things like holiday light strings, cords, and plastic bags should not be put in the recycling bin, as they can get tangled up in equipment. Batteries and electronics should also not be put in recycling, as they can cause a fire if damaged. Items like cardboard, glass, and aluminum cans can be recycled, and a full list of accepted items can be found online. The sniffles, sneezes, coughs, and wheezes could be coming your way. It is cold and flu season, after all. Are you taking your over-the-counter medication properly? Brittany Merlot reports.
Got that common winter cold coming on? You should know that there are common mistakes happening when people pick up over-the-counter medicines.
Patients at times may not read the labels or know what the active ingredients are in each medication.
That's Stetson Petrikis, an Aspyrus Pharmacy resident. He said that sometimes people are taking two different products with the same ingredients in them, which doubles the dose and may increase side effects.
It is best to talk to your doctor when, say, if you have a cough, if you've been trying to treat it over the counter and it's been about a week and then the cough gets worse, let your provider know.
He says read the label and make sure it's not a combination product.
Sports bring a lot into the Wisconsin economy, and basketball is no different. Stuart J. Waddles has more.
The Bucks are a multi-billion dollar operation. A recent NBA franchise valuation report reveals the Bucks rank 19th in the NBA with a value of $3.9 billion. The valuation is way up from a $550 million purchase price in 2014.
I'm Lisa Hale, Civic Media News. For news anytime, visit civicmedia.us.
The Bucks beat the Pacers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks struggled in the first half, but were able to pull out a 120-112 win on the road over the Indiana Pacers. Doc Rivers on what made the difference in the second half.
Well, you know, at halftime, I thought offensively we didn't play well. I thought we took pretty much bad shots. We turned the ball over, and then the wide open shots we had, we didn't make, and we were down 11. And so I'm thinking at halftime, like, this game can go our way still. I thought the zone turned the game around for us, obviously, defensively. And I thought we fell into two sets, that our spread and our angle, where we spaced the floor open so we can go downhill and make plays. And I thought our passing improved in the second half. And once we start passing to each other, we kept scoring.
College hoops. Number 8th ranked Marquette beat Providence 78-50 in Rhode Island. Cam Jones with 18 points and 10 assists for the Golden Eagles. NFL, the Packers back at practice, preparing to host the Bears on Sunday. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Happy New Year. I'm meteorologist Brandon Bormans. A colder start to 2025 with mostly cloudy skies, but on the breezy side as well, with temperatures falling into the lower 20s by late in the day. Mostly cloudy tonight, a low near 14. Partly sunny on Thursday with a high near 21. Currently, it's 21 degrees.
Matt Nair on air. This shouldn't be a thing.
Hot Dr. Pepper is the hottest holiday drink, but is it any good?
Jane, I'd like to answer that question. Yes.
No. Have you ever had a hot soda in your life?
Yes, they're terrible. You can also do apparently 80% eggnog and 20% Dr. Pepper.
Get out of my country.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Maggie is away during this holiday season, taking some well-deserved time off, but she will be back in this chair, in this studio, as a part of her continuing commitment to all of us and our larger communities here in the Civic Media realm. My name is Jim Santel, and delighted to be with you, honored to be with you on this first day of January of 2025, even though a very sobering day, a day of violence in America, not only in New Orleans, but also, of course, in New York and other places, regrettably, around our nation. And so as we come into our discussion, inviting you into our exchange, my wonderful producer, Cardi, also taking your phone calls at 855-752-4842. That number once again, 855-752-4842. Your questions, your comments, your observations about any of this on our extensive syllabus here on January 1 of 2025, right before the top of the hour. We began to talk about some of the legislation that has been passed by the United States Congress in the waning days of 2024 and signed by the President of the United States of America. 50 bills altogether in recent days, including, yes, indeed, that legislation making the bald eagle our national bird, much to the upsettedness, if he were still alive, of Benjamin Franklin. Nonetheless, finally, our national bird, considerably more significantly, also talking about other legislation that has been signed by the president, including that Stop Institutional Child Abuse Act that ensures that entities, agencies, companies, businesses that purport to provide support and therapy and treatment and counseling for youth are qualified to do so, are accredited, that there are rules and regulations for them to do just that. The Stop Institutional Child Abuse Act, new legislation coming out of our Congress just this past term. We know the new Congress, the 119th Congress, going to be convening just later this week. All of this legislation coming out of the last days of the 118th Congress, and that includes other legislation, including the National American Child Protection Act, the No Corruption Act, and indeed the Stop Campus Hazing Act. And Cardi, I think you've got some reporting on some of this well.
Yes, I do. One second. Here we go.
President Biden celebrated the holidays with a bill signing blitz on Christmas Eve, including one that formally makes the bald eagle the country's official bird.
Starting with bald eagles and concluding with a hazing bill that many people, many activists have been pushing forward to address college hazing. The anti-hazing law signed by President Biden would require schools to report annually incidents of hazing on their campuses. You know, federal law already requires schools to report safety issues, safety incidents on campuses. That now expands to include hazing. You also see at the bottom of your screen the No Corruption Act. That's actually addressed at members of Congress to deny members of Congress who are convicted of public corruption issues, bribery, fraud, from collecting federal retirement benefits. It comes in the same year we saw members of Congress either convicted of or plead guilty to corruption issues. Bob Menendez, the New Jersey senator, convicted at trial. George Santos, the former New York congressman, pleaded guilty to face sentencing in February. But also, we saw Paris Hilton lobbying Congress in recent weeks, trying to get through a law that President Biden signed, among the others, that would crack down on abuse of young people in residential treatment facilities. Wide range of laws, but this is typical at the end of a Congress, the end of a presidency, when they're finishing up old business.
All of that reporting, of course, significant because the 118th Congress is now a part of our history. The 119th Congress, of course, coming into play. Lots of challenges there just ahead. Indeed, indeed, this Stop Campus Hazing Act, no small piece of legislation. Bipartisan support for this once again. As reporting just indicated, colleges and universities now have some additional reporting requirements, have to start collecting statistics and issuing public reports accessible to you and me on hazing incidents on campus. That's federal legislation passed by our Congress, signed by our president. Victim families have been advocating for this legislation for a very long time. It applies to athletic teams and clubs as well as fraternities and sororities on colleges and universities nationwide. The law significantly also requires schools to provide hazing prevention programs. Let's stop this at the start, right? And that has to apply and be directed to both students and staff. That's the Stop Campus Hazing Act, now a part of our national records, our national legislation as a result of what the 118th Congress just did. And then, as you also heard, this thing called the No Corruption Act. It's officially given the long title of No Congressional Obligated Recurring Revenue Used as Pensions to Incarcerated Officials Now Act. That's a very long name for legislation generally referred to as the No Corruption Act. It is intended, again, to address the situation where you have members of Congress, former members of Congress, who continue to get pensions, your tax dollars paying for them. It is plainly bad news for those lawmakers who are convicted of felonies involving corruption. You know who those are just from recent reporting. George Santos, again. And in addition to that, Senator Bob Menendez, felony charges, including bribery. Both of them, members of Congress, prevented now by virtue of this No Corruption Act from ever collecting a pension. Specifies that any member of Congress who is convicted of a felony related to corruption, it's got to be that narrow, got to be that focused, will immediately lose access to their pension. Now, some previous legislation in this same area generally allowed former members to receive a pension until the appeals process was exhausted. In other words, both Santos and Menendez, of course, appealing this. This legislation now brings that to an end. The appeals, as you well know, can drag on for long periods of time. This now provides that there will be immediate cessation of access to pensions. And all of that, again, a part of the No Corruption Act, now a part of the laws of our nation. And finally, the Native American Child Protection Act, another major piece of legislation among the five or so that we're talking about here on the Maggie Dawn Show, because once again, it affects and protects a very vulnerable population, our youth. The law increases resources for investigating and then also prosecuting domestic violence and child abuse and neglect among our Native American communities, a subject of a lot of focus, not only by the Congress, by state legislatures, by law enforcement authorities, by private groups, by semi-private groups in recent years, protecting our Native American children. The legislation specifically, again, it's the Native American Child Protection Act, revises some programs first put into place way back in the 1990s. It updates them and brings them more current and includes some specific provisions in the law to create a national center, a national database, if you will, to provide assistance and training to tribes, tribal law enforcement, to staff of tribes, to members of tribes and urban Indian groups,
as well as endorsing some culturally appropriate treatment and resources. So in other words, we're not only providing some monies to provide and address this issue of domestic violence, child abuse among our Native American youth populations, but also doing it in a way that assures that it's culturally appropriate and reflective of appropriate and current treatment and resource allocations that we make in this area and many other areas. Assistance and training to tribes, the leadership, and urban Indian groups throughout the nation. You know that in Wisconsin, of course, we have 11 federally recognized tribes. All of them can and will benefit from this Native American Child Protection Act, now a part of our national legislation. Joe Biden signing that into law among 45 other pieces of legislation in the waning days of 2024. We know as well that the 119th Congress again convenes this coming Friday. Lots of focus on what's going to happen there, including its leadership. We know that the Speaker, Mike Johnson, who is seeking once again to be identified by a majority of the members of the House of Representatives as the next Speaker, not without some challenges and an awful lot of people wondering whether or not he will retain that position as Speaker. Why is that important as you go into 119th Congress? Well, we saw in the 118th Congress that when you do not have a Speaker, everything else stops. Cannot proceed with appointments to committees, cannot organize, cannot, importantly, propose and work on new legislation in the 119th Congress. It is the threshold event that has to happen before anything else can happen in the United States Congress. And yes, indeed, on January 6th, what is supposed to happen in the United States Congress? We know that on that's the date that the United States Congress, led by the President of the Senate, that's the Vice President of the United States right now, her name is and continues to be, of course, Kamala Harris. She will join the present Speaker of the House. His name, of course, right now is Mike Johnson. We'll see if he continues to hold that position. On January 6th, they're going to do what we saw last time, the subject of so much violence on Capitol Hill, that briefly suspended the counting of those electoral votes. Going to do it again next week. Counting those electoral votes, if indeed the 119th Congress can go ahead with leadership, can go ahead with that all-important result of the election, not just in November, but also in December. December 17th was the day on which all of the electors throughout the United States of America met. And that's the date that we actually elected, if you will, a next president. His name is Donald Trump, as you well know. Significant events coming up in the days just immediately ahead. The days, of course, that we'll see a 119th Congress and important work heading toward the not only the appointment of new people inside the new administration, but as a predicate to all of that, the swearing in, the inauguration of the 47th president of the United States of America, and his name is Donald Trump. That happening on January 20th. January, a very important date, always every 4 years in the history of our nation. This time, no small historical event either. All of that happening, of course, on the broadcast stations, the reporting we provide here on the Maggie Dawn Show and in other stations, other broadcasts as well. In that connection, a bit of a programming note as well as we go into the last moments of this segment. I'm going to be appearing again on the John and Gordy Show tomorrow morning at 7:30. Friday, I'm going to be appearing on the Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. And on Friday afternoon on the Dom Salvia Show, all of that talking about these major issues and talking, of course, about Jimmy Carter as well. We'll get back to that in the next segments here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
To love, I got caught in the rush hour. These fellas.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
When severe weather hits and the power goes out, do you have a plan? For reliable power and peace of mind, propane can do that. It only takes about 10 seconds for a propane powered generator to restore power to your home. So no matter what Mother Nature has in store, you know you're prepared. Learn more at WIPGA.org. This message is sponsored by your local propane provider and the Wisconsin Propane Education and Research Council.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Yesterday, we reported on attempts by anti-voter legislators in Arizona to make it harder to get citizen ballot initiatives on the ballot and a higher threshold to pass one. Another suppression tactic by opponents? Slap signature canvassers with a subpoena. Recruiting and training a legion of canvassers to put a measure on the ballot is already an expensive proposition. As we noted yesterday, should the Arizona Distribution Requirement for Initiatives Amendment pass in November, signatures would be required from all 30 legislative districts in Arizona, meaning more volunteers and more expense. Bolts Magazine reports on another tactic: take the ballot question organizers to court. Opponents hope that by challenging the question's text, signature collection methods, and eligibility of canvassers, it can either invalidate signatures or make it financially unfeasible to continue. A recent Arizona law allows opponents to subpoena canvassers to defend their petitions, and if they don't appear, the signatures can be tossed out. Bolts Magazine chronicles a 2018 climate ballot question that had 1,400 canvassers subpoenaed, and organizers spent $1.3 million transporting and housing canvassers, most of whom never even testified. Expect more such tactics as anti-voter legislators try to keep power out of the hands of citizens. We've linked the Bolts Magazine article at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name is Jim Santel, guest hosting for Maggie on this first day of January of 2025, a sobering day in our nation, across our planet, as we once again witness violence of unspeakable dimensions in New Orleans, New York, other places throughout our nation, regrettably, and across our planet generally. We know as well that even while that happens, that news continues to animate much of our discussion. We were speaking just before the last break about the many pieces of legislation that our current president has signed that are going to change the way that we understand support of principally our youth and other people who are in need of support and assistance as we go forward. All of that very positive legislation. We'll look forward to the 119th Congress convening in the days just ahead and see what they do in the next 2 years following the identification of their leadership. Along the way, one of the things, of course, that they will decide is the actual counting of votes coming out of the Electoral College way back in mid-December of just this past year. That's supposed to happen on January 6th. And, of course, we presume that at that time, the United States Congress will open those votes from the electors around the nation and identify Donald Trump as our next president of the United States of America and then be sworn in on January 20th on the west side of the Capitol, part of the historic events that we always view and take in when new presidents come into power. Along the way, we note that Donald Trump continues to be in litigation. We know that he continues to be a convicted felon and still is subject to oversight and perhaps some involvement in that case in New York City, in which he was found guilty of 34 counts of violations of federal law, false statements, fraudulent records in connection with payments to Stormy Daniels to keep her quiet about an affair that he allegedly had with her right before the 2016 election. All of that still pending in front of Judge Juan Merchan in New York, still not brought to a resolution in that trial court level. Plainly, depending upon what the judge says, that matter may well go up on appeal or could be stayed. We will see what will happen in that New York court. But we do know that in another court, a federal court, Donald Trump was also an actor just recently. The president-elect, just this past week, failed to overturn that $5 million judgment that was entered again by the court, finding that he sexually abused a writer, her name is E. Jean Carroll, in that Bergdorf Goodman dressing room in the mid-1990s, and he later defamed her
calling her a liar, calling her a fraud, calling all this a hoax, and all of that subject then to his appeal. Donald Trump's lawyers had argued to a federal appeals court. Again, this goes up to a federal appeals court that a lower court in Manhattan had erred by allowing two women to testify in that E. Jean Carroll trial that he had also sexually assaulted them. This is also called prior acts. And the allegation here is that the judge improperly permitted that to come in. The lawyers had also argued that the court should not have allowed E. Jean Carroll's lawyers to play the recording of that very infamous Access Hollywood conversation. Recall that well. There was one in which Donald Trump bragged in very vulgar terms about grabbing women. Recall that, unfortunately, in the history of our nation. The appeals court, again, reviewing what happened at the trial court level, rejected all of that, rejected his request for a new trial in the case, and produced the smaller of the two defamation judgments against him, that coming out of the trial that they specifically reviewed. They said this: Mr. Trump has not demonstrated that the district court erred in any of the challenge rulings. That was an opinion of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, which is basically New York and other states in that vicinity. It was unsigned, but it was executed, entered by a three-judge panel made up by judges named Denny Chin and Susan Carney, as well as Myrna Perez. Both E. Jean Carroll and I are gratified by today's decision. That's the attorney for E. Jean Carroll. Her name is Roberta Kaplan. We thank the Second Circuit for its careful consideration of the party's arguments, again, affirming the lower court judgment of $5 million in that sex abuse case. Stephen Chung, who's Donald Trump's chief campaign spokesman, had a little different view of all of that. He said that the American people demand an immediate end to the politicization of our justice system, a swift dismissal of all of the witch hunts, including, as he said, the Democrat-funded Carroll hoax, which will continue to be appealed. So he is promising an appeal to the United States Supreme Court, apparently, from this entry of judgment by the Second Circuit. During the trial last year, E. Jean Carroll testified, again, you may recall, in some lurid detail, that she had run into Donald Trump at Bergdorf's on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. And at that time, according to her testimony, he asked her to help him buy a present for a friend of hers. Carroll testified also that they wound up in the lingerie department, where Donald Trump pulled her into a dressing room and assaulted her. Said that Donald Trump shoved her against a wall and engaged in that violent behavior at the time. Trump did not testify at the trial. He denied any wrongdoing, claimed that he never met E. Jean Carroll. He earned a rebuke from the judge, whose name is Lewis Kaplan, not to be confused with E. Jean Carroll's attorney, when he posted on his own social media outlet, that's Truth Social, that the lawyer and the position taken by her, all this was a scam. And Donald Trump wrote that Carroll's lawyer was a political operative. Trump also said that the dress that E. Jean Carroll wore at Bergdorf's that day should be allowed to be a part of the case. The jury of six men and three women found that Donald Trump had sexually abused E. Jean Carroll, but did not find that he had raped her. Unclear why the jurors chose that lesser offense of abuse over rape, but that is the judgment that has now been affirmed by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Federal jury also found, of course, that Donald Trump defamed E. Jean Carroll when he wrote on Truth Social that her case was a complete con job, his words, a hoax and a lie. The jury ordered him to pay $5 million in damages. And this year, another Manhattan jury, as you may recall, ordered Donald Trump to pay another $83.3 million for defaming E. Jean Carroll in 2019 after she made these accusations. A lot of things going on in those civil proceedings here. Those will continue, obviously, even as Donald Trump is sworn in as our next president of the United States of America, but suffering a loss from the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit just this past week, affirming that $5 million judgment in the sex abuse case. More coming from Washington, D.C., as the Maggie Dawn Show continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
Yeah.
This is Locally Grown Radio, WFHR. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
The large soybean crop in South America is going to put a lid on soybean prices. I'm Charity Seebecker for the Midwest Farm Report. A market advisor, Jen Heimberg with Total Farm Marketing in West Bend, still saw some support this past week for a few reasons, though.
But we saw a powerful move in the soybean meal complex over the last couple of weeks. Two things came into play there. First off, investors, in terms of those hedge funds, were sitting on a record short position in soybean meal just with a potential supply of soybean meal that's out there. We actually got those commitment of trader numbers yesterday for the 24th of December, Christmas Eve, and they were sitting on 95,000 short contracts, and that by far was the largest position they've been short. Then we also got a little bit of a talk of maybe some drying forecasts in Argentina. You're looking at a market that has zero weather premium in it. So we saw a big jump in soybean meal prices, about $30 a ton here over a handful of days.
That's John Heimberg, market advisor with Total Farm Marketing. I'll look at your closing markets right after this.
You see the headlines all the time. Consumers confused by food labels. Well, not if they shop at Bavaria Sausage. Fabulous Farm Babe Pam Yonke here, asking you to take a closer look at the food labels at Bavaria Sausage. You know, they are working towards making sure when you take a look at whatever product they've got in the store, you know exactly what it is. They're using different colors. They're also making sure that there's a picture on that label to help you better understand the protein source that you're looking at. It's all about making sure they're combining the old world flavors, the artisan blends, and making sure that you understand when there's something new in the showcase, what is it and where did it come from? Simple information, easily understood. And of course, there's always someone there to answer your questions if you've got them. Bavaria Sausage at the corner of Nesbitt Road, Fitchrona Road in Fitchburg, located also online, BavariaSausage.com. Old recipes, new labels. Take a look.
I'm Charity Seebecker for the Midwest Farm Report with a look at your closing markets. Cash corn closed at 458.5, up 6.25. New crop corn closed at 443.75, up 4.75. January cash beans closed at 998.25, up 16.25 cents. In November, new crop beans closed at 1025.25, up 17 cents. March cash wheat closed at 551.5, up 3.25. And July 2025 new crop wheat closed at 569.5, also up 3.25 cents. January classic milk contract is trading at 2031 a hundredweight, down 12 cents, and February milk is trading at 2034, down 33 cents. Barrel cheese closed at 182.5, up 1.75. 40-pound block cheese had no change and closed at 191, and the AA butter closed down 2 cents and closed at 255. For the Midwest Farm Report, I'm Charity Seebecker.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Happy New Year. I'm meteorologist Brandon Bormans. A colder start to 2025 with mostly cloudy skies, but on the breezy side as well, with temperatures falling into the lower 20s by late in the day. Mostly cloudy tonight, a low near 14. Partly sunny on Thursday with a high near 21. Currently, it's 21 degrees.
The Badgers.
Seeds Max fakes the three, takes the three. Left side, yes, sir.
Flee.
Pivots, fades, flips, good again. Just outside the left elbow.
Here.
Goes up, got it. With the right hand, it counts at a foul.
This is your radio home for Wisconsin Badger basketball.
Brought to you by 8th Street Auto, Econ Electric, and Johnson & Sons Chrysler Jeep. Listen on 97.5 FM, 1320 AM WFHR, streaming live on the Civic Media app.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
What's going on in Washington today as we move into 2025? Have your antenna up. Don't rely on all the media sources, just your own wisdom, your own heart, your own gut. Listen to what they're saying about our friends and neighbors and family, because we innately know these people that we live with every day in our communities. Don't allow words and thoughts to tear us apart. Hold fast to that which we know, which is good.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie on this first day of January of 2025, the first day of the new year when, regrettably, a time of celebration, we are instead witnessing these horrific attacks around our nation, specifically in New Orleans, as investigators continue to piece together that horrific event there, and also New York, other places throughout our nation, across our planet, when violence continues to upset the safety and the security and the well-being that all human beings should enjoy. We commission ourselves to do better in 2025 so that on January 1 of 2026, a year from now, we can truly celebrate a year of some renewed safety and security for all of us. In that connection, at the end of the past year of 2024, we also had a Chief Justice talking about those kinds of issues. At the end of every year, the Chief Justice issues a report on the judiciary, the state of the judiciary, if you will, talking about the things that are accomplished. This past year, no difference, no departure from that tradition. John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, issuing this report and talking in particular about threats to the judicial system. He's writing about disgruntled lawmakers and litigants who pose a threat to judicial independence. He didn't name anyone specifically when he admonished public officials for intimidating judges, but we can tell probably who he was talking about. The report that was published just earlier this week delved into the dangers posed by disgruntled politicians and litigants against judges and the wider judicial system. Robert said in his report that some of the judicial decisions that happen are egregiously wrong, those are his words, and merit pushback, but that not all actors engage in informed criticism. And by actors, of course, he's talking about people who would criticize unfairly the actions of justices and judges. He wrote this. He said, "I feel compelled to address four areas of legitimate activity that, in my view, do threaten the independence of judges on which the rule of law depends. And those are violence, intimidation, disinformation, and threats to defy lawfully entered judgments." He wrote, "Disappointed litigants rage at judicial decisions on the internet, urging readers to send a message to the judge." That sounds candidly like what Donald Trump has done, as we know well. "They falsely claim that the judge had it in for them because of the judge's race, gender, or ethnicity, or the political party of the president who appointed the judge." This is all from the pen of the Chief Justice. "Trump, Donald Trump, our next president, has very notably clashed with judges presiding over many of the cases against him, including that one that we just talked about that is involving E. Jean Carroll, but also other cases, his criminal matters as well. He was repeatedly fined for violating the orders restricting his public statements during that New York hush money case. He was held in contempt of court after criticizing the Supreme Court during an interview with Real America's Voice in April." And so all of that, although now he is not mentioned by name, plainly the target of the Chief Justice. John Roberts admonishes public officials for attempting to intimidate judges, though, again, he didn't name any of them by name. Public officials, he said, certainly have a right to criticize the work of the judiciary, but they should be mindful that intemperance in their statements when it comes to judges may prompt dangerous reactions by others. Chief Justice admonished some lawmakers for trying to defy his decisions. "Elected officials from across the political spectrum have raised the specter of open disregard for federal court rulings." And of course, all of that comes in the wake of continued reporting on ethical problems inside the Supreme Court as well. The Judiciary Committee of the United States Senate issuing just this past week another report commenting generally upon the Supreme Court and judges in particular, that including Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito, identifying additional instances in which Clarence Thomas did not report gifts he received from Harlan Crow. And all of that, of course, taking place inside this larger discussion about whether or not there should be an enforceable code of ethics. Right now, there's a set of standards and practices, but not enforceable by anyone aside from the judges themselves, the justices themselves, who may choose to take that on. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts railing against some of the criticism against him, some of it perhaps legitimate, some of it not perhaps legitimate, but nonetheless,
in the public domain now for our general consumption as the Supreme Court, of course, continues to entertain oral arguments in this month of January and in February, and then presumably issuing many opinions in the coming months, including June and July, about many, many issues that affect our lives and livelihoods. Supreme Court in 2025 plainly will continue to be a lot of focus of discussion here on the Maggie Dawn Show, on other broadcasts of civic media. Finally, on this first day of the new year, we think, of course, about the 39th president of the United States of America, James Earl Carter. He was born on October 1 of 1924, and of course, as you know, he died on December 29th. He was an American politician, and he was also a humanitarian. He was the 39th president of the United States of America, that tenure, 1977, elected in 1976 to 1981. He was undeniably a Democrat. He served from 1963 to 1967 in the Georgia State Senate, 1971 to 1975 as the 76th governor of the state of Georgia. And of course, as you know well, he was the longest living president in United States history, the first to live to the age of 100. He was born in Plains, Georgia, as you also well know, which is also where he died. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1946, joined the submarine service as a part of his commission. He married Rosalind Smith. They worked closely together throughout their lives. Again, part of the history of Jimmy Carter in our nation's lives. He returned home after his military service and revived his family's peanut growing business. Opposing racial segregation, Jimmy Carter was a big advocate for the growing civil rights movement that engendered an awful lot of criticism at the time. He supported that. He became an activist within the Democratic Party there in the state of Georgia. After serving in the Senate there and then as governor, he ran for president, that in 1976. He was undeniably a dark horse for that position. He was not well known outside of Georgia. He won the Democratic nomination in 1976 and narrowly defeated the incumbent president, Gerald Ford, in that election of that year, the 1976 presidential election. Among other things that he did, he pardoned all Vietnam War draft evaders on his second day in office. He created a national energy policy that included conservation and price control and new technology. And in that connection, Jimmy Carter was also a great advocate for the environment and preserving our resources. He was sometimes ridiculed for this, but he was in many ways before his time when he came to advocating that all Americans can do things to preserve the future of our nation and our world when it comes to energy policy. And Carter, I think you've got some audio again of Jimmy Carter speaking to the nation, encouraging us to be mindful about energy then in the late 1970s, and certainly words to this day that are important.
Oh, yeah. Here we go. Jimmy Carter.
Due to the energy crisis in the U.S., President Carter decided to give this notable speech known as the Crisis of Confidence speech in July of 1979.
To further conserve energy, I'm proposing tonight an extra $10 billion over the next decade to strengthen our public transportation systems. And I'm asking you for your good and for your nation's security to take no unnecessary trips, to use carpools or public transportation whenever you can, to park your car one extra day per week, to obey the speed limit, and to set your thermostats to save fuel. Every act of energy conservation like this is more than just common sense. I tell you, it is an act of patriotism.
That's Jimmy Carter addressing the nation. And for that speech that speaks to us even today in 2025, this first day of the new year, getting a fair amount of pushback on that and suggesting that his recommendations about how we can all be personally responsible for our future, that he got an awful lot of ridicule for that and suggested that things like wearing a sweater and doing other things, again, like turning down the thermostat and thinking about your driving practices, all those very practical things, that's the Jimmy Carter of that time that ask all of us to do things committed to our nation as a group of people who believe in its future. I will tell you, as a point of personal observation here, that I had the great honor in the summer of 1980 to witness Jimmy Carter's commitment to the future of our nation, energy efficiency, and climate issues when I served as, yes, I was very young at the time, a staff intern in the West Wing of the White House in the summer of 1980. Now, Jimmy Carter would go on, of course, as I said, to accept the presidential nomination once again in 1980 of the Democratic Party. He would lose very notably, in a major way to Ronald Reagan in the course of that campaign. But in the summer of 1980, that Jimmy Carter, who was campaigning even at that period of time, the summer of 1980, Jimmy Carter was concerned about energy. Perhaps again today, the single biggest issue that faces not only our leaders here in the United States, but around the nation. I was an intern in the Carter White House in those months of the summer of 1980. And specifically, I worked for a woman named Erica Ward, and she was, among others, an assistant to Stuart Eisenstadt, who was the president's domestic affairs and policy advisor at the time. Also worked for a fellow named Bert Karp. He was a deputy assistant to the president for domestic policies and affairs at that time. And in that time, I recall very well that the president, Jimmy Carter, was committed to the future of the nation. I was honored on July 22nd of 1980 to be present when on the South Lawn of the White House, the president, Jimmy Carter, presented the President's Awards for Energy Efficiency, identifying entities and businesses and other groups that had been at the forefront of this effort to try to keep our nation's energy in place. Of course, this was a time when gas prices were high, when there was a concern about the future sources of oil and energy generally in America. He was awarding those entities way back in 1980. They're already thinking about the future of our nation. He awarded those groups, those entities, those individuals who were concerned about a future, and a future also that focused upon climate. On June 30th of 1980, a few weeks before that, he also signed the Energy Security Act of 1980. And once again, I was honored. It remains one of the great honors and recollections of my life to be president again on the South Lawn of the White House when this president, Jimmy Carter, signed the Energy Security Act of 1980. All sorts of policies and procedures that were, again, passed by the Congress, enforced by the executive branch, and endorsed in a major way by this president at that time. Forward thinking, he could not possibly have imagined, again, what would happen in 2024, 2025, and the years of recent times when we have come again to appreciate the significance of climate and energy and the ways of using energy responsibly for future generations. Jimmy Carter was ahead of his time in 1980. And he made this a part of his campaign, not only in 1976, but also in 1980, when he campaigned unsuccessfully for the presidency going ahead. One of the great experiences of my lifetime, serving as an intern in the Jimmy Carter White House in the summer of 1980. I was headed off to law school that fall. Jimmy Carter, of course, again, one of the hugely significant presidents in our nation's history. And as we continue to discuss him in memorial of his tenure on this planet and as our president, we're going to be addressing in particular this notion that somehow his presidency was not successful and that his post-presidency was more successful. We'll take that up and determine whether or not that's true, according to an awful lot of people who were there at the time and who have since had the time to evaluate that. All of that as the Maggie Dawn Show continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
Ho-Chunk Gaming Madison, home of the Big Win and Madison Casino Guru, is transforming guests into winners, making an ordinary day into a big win day is easy with a 95% average payout. And with over 140 daily jackpots,
The number of people winning has never been bigger. So what are you waiting for? Escape to Ho-Chunk Gaming Madison for your next big win.
Ho-Chunk Gaming Madison.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. As 2024 comes to a close, we're taking our annual look back at the year that was, recapping our most read, most listened to, and most impactful stories of the year. If you're new to learning about the Recombobulation area, this would be a great place to start to see what we're all about. This year, we covered the RNC in Milwaukee and the DNC in Chicago and broke stories that made national news along the way. We wrote about the fight for fair maps and covered elections in the state legislature like no one else. I wrote opinion columns and feature stories and conducted extended sit-down interviews like one with Senator Tammy Baldwin. I hosted podcasts and radio shows and, of course, joined the Civic Media Network, where you've heard me all over the airwaves for the last few months. This last year was discombobulating at times, but we did our best to make sense of it all, and we've got a whole lot more recombobulation in store for the year ahead in 2025.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but still, you shine at useless information, and WFHR and Culver's want to reward you.
Welcome back.
Join the morning show Fridays for a chance to win one value basket and a kid's meal. Be our next superstar with Culver's Star of the Day every Friday at 97.5 FM WFHR.
You're listening to locally grown radio WFHR.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie. In this, the final segment of our broadcast on this first day of the new year, and remembering the 39th President of the United States of America, not only based upon my own presence there, not in the Oval Office on a daily basis, but serving in the West Wing of the White House and the domestic policy staff for all of the important accomplishments of this president. And pushing back today on this notion that his presidency somehow was unsuccessful, and that his post-presidency, which we know well, was hugely successful, somehow eclipsed the things that he did during the 4 years that he was our chief executive. Listen to what Jimmy Carter said at the time of his campaign, the first campaign for the presidency. He talked about the future of America that animated the things that indeed he did during the course of those 4 years as the president. He said, "I see an America that has turned away from scandals and corruption." Of course, he's making reference to what he was coming off of at the time, which was the Watergate scandal, Richard Nixon. He said, "I see an American president who governs with vigor and vision and affirmative leadership." And indeed, he did. He said, "A president who is not isolated from our people, but a president who feels your pain and who shares your dreams." He said, "I see an America on the move again, united, its wounds healed. An America entering its third century with confidence and competence and compassion. An America that lives up to the majesty of its Constitution and the simple decency of its people. That," he said, "is my vision of America. I hope you share it, and I hope you will help me fight for it." Indeed, that is what animated an awful lot of what Jimmy Carter did. It is sometimes, again, in the public domain, almost taken as an act of faith that Jimmy Carter's presidency was not successful. And although we recognize hugely that his post-presidency was a time of great accomplishment, much of which we're going to talk about in future broadcasts this week on not only on Amicus, a law review this coming Saturday, but also tomorrow, December 2nd, on the John and Gordy Show. On Friday on Up North News, on the Dom Salvia Show on Friday afternoon, we're going to talk about all kinds of things related to Jimmy Carter and his legacy post-presidency, but also during his presidency itself. In addition to creating this national energy policy that we talked about already, including conservation, price controls, and new technology, ahead of its time, language and policies
that would find a good place, a warm place in the policy discussion right now about climate issues and the future of the planet. He was talking about that in the 1970s and working toward the things that today we would embrace as absolutely necessary to the future of our planet. But beyond that, we know that Jimmy Carter successfully pursued those Camp David Accords that brought together Egypt and Israel for the first time. Beginning again at Camp David, but working on that for a long period of time to begin to lay the groundwork for some level of peace in the Middle East. The Camp David Accords, those have not only his pen, but also his insight and perspective all over them. The Panama Canal treaties, recently once again in the news as the incoming president, Donald Trump, talks critically about Jimmy Carter and Jimmy Carter's negotiation of a treaty that turned that Panama Canal over to the Panamanians to the betterment of our globe, not only the Panamanian government, but also the United States government and any other country that chooses to use the Panama Canal for its commerce and its good movement going forward. The Panama Canal treaties, that was a part of the legacy of Jimmy Carter as the president. He pursued also the second round of strategic arms limitation talks, significant in attempting to reduce the threat that all of us continue to face, plainly, of nuclear proliferation and nuclear annihilation. He talked a lot about the future of a nation, a future of a planet, all sorts of countries that limit those strategic arms that could destroy who we are. He confronted what's called stagflation. His administration established the U.S. Department of Energy and the Department of Education, both of those created, again, respectively, because of his commitment to energy and in the future and a safe and secure planet. And yes, indeed, he was also an education president. It was during his term where the Department of Education was created, a department that the incoming president, as we know well, is proposing to rescind, to remove and to bring to an end. The Department of Education doing an awful lot of things immediately after its creation, but also in the many years since that time to ensure equities and the provision of monies and resources for education in America, our young people and people beyond their youth. That was the brainchild, that was the product of the Jimmy Carter administration. Now, the end of his presidency, as we all know, was marked by the Iran-Contra crisis, and there was and this energy crisis that was due to the Iranian Revolution. We had the Three Mile Island accident, but he also established diplomatic relations with China and also engaged in many, many other overseas attempts to keep our world safer and more secure. After leaving the presidency, of course, the Carter Center was the basis upon which all of his post-presidency work was pursued. We'll talk more about that as we remember Jimmy Carter. In these days, following his death recently, he will be lying in state on the 9th of January. That plainly will focus our attention once again on the legacy that is our 39th president, a legacy that I would say needs to be revisited today to identify the accomplishments that were his during his 4 years in the White House. I appreciate so much your spending this first day of January and of the new year with me and my terrific producer, Cardi. Stay with us for all these future broadcasts here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Happy New Year, everyone.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
Ready, set, go.
Get in the game and be heard with WFHR's Playmakers. Join us 5 to 6 Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We're here to take your calls, sports takes, and ramblings. We'll have breaking stories, game day conversations with players, coaches, and you. Nobody ever made a highlight from the sidelines. Join the team here at WFHR 97.5 FM, 1320 AM, 5 to 6 PM Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for WFHR's Playmakers.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News special report. The FBI believes the man who drove a pickup truck into a crowd in New Orleans this morning, killing 10 people, had help. FBI agent Alethea Duncan.
This is an ongoing investigation that's rapidly evolving.
Agent Duncan says 42-year-old Shamsuddin Jabbar, an American citizen from Texas, was prepared to do a lot of damage.
Weapons and potential improvised explosive devices, IEDs, were located in the subject's vehicle. Other potential IEDs were also located in the French Quarter. As of now, two IEDs have been found and rendered safe.
CBS's Nicole Skanga says a handgun and an AR-15 style weapon were found, and that's not all.
Law enforcement sources telling us that at least four IEDs, improvised explosive devices, were recovered from the scene of the crash. And at this point, trying to connect the dots to determine whether, you know, those IEDs would have been viable.
CBS News special report. I'm Christopher Cruz.